from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out why they're asking why arts, why indie at the University of Indianapolis.
I'll get a preview of this year's Indianapolis School of Ballet's Nutcracker.
And I'll talk with musician Tom Akins about his new memoir, Behind the Copper Fence. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. In the wake of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra's highly visible and protracted contract negotiations, the University of Indianapolis has organized a December 10th public conversation called Why Arts, Why Indie? Exploring the Future of Creative Culture in Indianapolis. Michael Kaiser, president of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Arts and noted arts turnaround manager, is the featured guest, joined by a local panel of mostly performing arts representatives and moderator Dennis Ryerson. Sharon Gamble invited event organizer Kathleen Hacker, associate professor and chair of the university's Department of Music, to tell us more.
Something that universities do is they ask a lot of questions, they gather data, they research, they ponder the universe, and honestly, that's what we academics do. So I just felt that we really needed to talk about the arts and where it stands in Indianapolis, and University of Indianapolis is primed to do that sort of, offer that sort of conversation and to convene that sort of conversation.
And I should ask you to articulate for our listeners, if they don't happen to know why you are a good choice to be thinking these questions, tell us about your arts tracks and programs.
Oh, well, we have a huge arts, well, of course, Crystal DeHaan, supported us a few years ago and gave us the financial means to have a huge arts community there. And it's thriving. We have a theater, we have art, we have visual art, we have, of course, we have all of our music tracks. And we have the written word, which is considered an art, creative art.
Sure.
You know, anything, to me, anything that's creative is artistic. And I just really believe that the capacity for us to create has got to be trained, has got to be worked on, has got to be developed. And so that happens across the spectrum. And the best way for a young person to access that is through the arts.
Now, most artists, when they're drawn to, say, sing and then mm-hmm. become an educator so you can share your talent with others and guide them, most artists don't think about, will there be a future for me? So is it a little bit of a shifting of gears to be pondering the question, what is the future of the arts?
Well, I think, you know, the arts is such a solitary, you have to sort of live with the art internally in a big way. And when you're being schooled, when you're being trained, those are the questions that you have to ask. And you really have to live internally in order to be, but then when the arts speak, that is a hugely universal process. And so, yes, the future of that has to be spoken about. But generally, students aren't there yet. It's certainly right after, when they get out into the real world and want to
now
speak
what?
Their art, then they realize, wow, that's a question I should have asked a while ago. So, sure.
But it's a good question to ask at any stage of life. Was there a particular... I mean, it's been a big year, big season, start to the mm-hmm. season with mm-hmm. Certainly with the negotiations with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra musicians, and you know, some turnover in some major arts posts. The executive director of the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel, the president and CEO of the Indianapolis Museum of Art, those positions have turned over. But there are always positions turning over in the mm-hmm. arts, and there are mm-hmm. always challenges to keep arts organizations alive. So was there something that was a little bit of a catalyst for the timing for this?
Well, I'll tell you, I started this whole process in my mind a few years ago, and I felt like the artist, the advocate, and the educator should all get together. And work with one another, to support one another with our specific strengths, and to commune. And I felt like there should be a venue for that to happen. And so a year or so ago, I tried to reach out to the educators because at that point, education, arts education was in huge concern. Areas in our neighborhoods were, you know, they're being put up on to be voted in or out of the school day. And so that was a huge concern for me. And so that got me started thinking about this, coming together as groups to talk about these things. And that didn't necessarily bear fruit, and not to anybody's fault, but I just think that the educators were so overwhelmed and so worried about getting there. They didn't want to talk about anything.
Sure.
They wanted to work, get something accomplished.
Yeah, they didn't have the luxury of
big-picture
conversations.
That's right.
They needed to hang on to their jobs and their...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that really started the concern. And then... of course, when the symphony was in negotiations, then the artistic community started questioning, whoa, if the symphony is having trouble, what does that mean for the small arts organization? And what does that mean for my arts organization tomorrow? You know, when you have an organization that seems to be a foundational member of your arts community be with such concerns.
In peril.
Yeah, in peril. So that coming together, that sort of galvanized the conversation. But ultimately, the conversation is a much broader one than that. It's more one for the universe of arts in Indianapolis. How can we better support our organizations? What do we need to do to remain relevant? What do we need to do as an arts organization in the 21st century to make our delivery comfortable or easy for people to access? You know, where are the portals for the community? What do we need to do? What do we need to find out about the convenience for people how can we get them into a room to experience
sure.
live art?
How do we get people away from their iPad? Mm-hmm. I'm looking at your iPad, which is sitting on the counter as we speak.
Has my notes.
There's nothing wrong with an iPad, folks, but there's a difference between watching a YouTube video of a performance and actually being at that performance.
I was thinking about that on the way in, you know, the energy, the electricity that's in the room when a live performance happens cannot be accessed. It cannot come across a YouTube performance. It just can't happen. And so how do you get people to understand that if they've never experienced it? How do you get them to remember that if they've never been? So how do we get them there to experience that so that they want to come back?
I don't want to steal any material from this conversation you're going to have, but can you say a little bit more about that? Certainly, I see you in the audience at events regularly, but can you say a little bit more about what you just said from a performer's viewpoint, why it's so important to have a live audience there?
Well, live performance is a living, breathing thing, and there's a give and take, and there's a response, and you feel from an audience, and you're ignited by that. That's part of the recreation of the art. And you know, I was thinking though, also on the way over, the Super Bowl, we were able to bring 46 murals to life for the Super Bowl in our community, and they're still there, and they're still speaking. There's still a testament to the art supporting the other parts of our community that are so important. I mean, you know, I would not want the arts instead of something else, but certainly alongside everything. So how does the live art speak that way? They have to continue to speak. They have to speak regularly. They have to speak effectively. They have to speak loudly. They have to speak relevantly and consistently in order to have that same sort of staying power. And that to me is a concern for the performing arts.
They have to become a habit.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a good habit. I'm here to tell you it's a great habit to have.
So as the calendar turns to January and you're thinking about your New Year's resolutions, maybe make the positive resolution to go to more concerts, go to more museum exhibits, what have you. Tell us about the panel you have gotten together.
You know, it's interesting. I wondered how on earth we could commune all the arts community, all the arts organizations in. And I thought, you know, the best way to bring in new people is to invite people from the recognizable arts community to engage on the full panel. And so we have Glenn Kwok from the International Violin Competition. We have David Hochoy from Dance Kaleidoscope, Beth Outland, who runs the education portion of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. We have Stephen Stolen from IRT. We have Jim Walker from Big Car, which is pretty awesome. And then as a moderator, Dennis Ryerson has agreed to help moderate, which I think is wonderful because, He's regarded as an objective voice in the community, I think.
And he has the big picture view of all the other issues that are demanding attention in the community.
Absolutely, which to me is really exciting. So we wanted that sort of a visible panel to get the conversation started and maybe to bring new people in. But I wanted the smaller organizations to speak. So we prepared, or are preparing right now, it's one of my major tasks between now and the 10th, is to, a video of little snippets. And we went to various arts organizations all over the community and said, ask them to answer two questions. What drew you to the arts in the first place? And what do you see as your greatest challenge in the 21st century facing your arts organization? And so we have little sound bites from a variety of arts organizations in the community. And then to engage a broader discussion, we have opened up these portals on Facebook and Twitter and our university webpage that ask the community to ask their questions or to express their concerns so that we can speak for the community. The panel did not want to be the ones doing the talking. They wanted to get the conversation going. And so then we wanted a bigger vision and somebody who could give us maybe a new perspective that we hadn't thought about. And so we invited Michael Kaiser. I just thought my mantra for this whole thing has been to think big, ask big, and everybody has responded so well. Michael Kaiser is willing to come and talk, but he didn't want to be a keynote speaker. He said, I don't want to just talk to you about things. He goes, I want to engage the community. I want to be interviewed. And so we changed the shape of the evening and actually have sort of, if you can imagine, the view a little bit more staid, a little bit more maybe, we hope to be a little bit more collected, you know, have a view. And then we have just sort of talk. And the questions that we ask are going to be the questions that the community submits. So I look for a really exciting conversation.
And Michael Kaiser, if you've not heard of him, just put him in your iPad search engine, folks. He's president of the Kennedy Center. But he's also he's kind of a not-for-profit arts turnaround artist,
yeah.
You know, turnaround manager,
king,
who's gone into organizations with amazing art that have had administrative issues and have figured out how to just spin them around so that they come back out swinging and with their funding intact. Speaking of funding, one of the challenges, I mean, it's you've lived in Indianapolis for a while.
Since 82.
82. Mm-hmm. So you've seen huge changes, as have I. I came here about 1970 from L.A. Lots and lots of new arts organizations. And while it's thrilling to see that, it means, wow, great, new energy, new people, not always young, by the way. Everybody mm-hmm. assumes it's 25-year-olds starting new arts organizations. Mm-hmm. It isn't always. But our population hasn't grown in the same way that the number of organizations that need support have grown.
I wish you could submit that to our questionnaire, because that's a very good question. But you know, I do think there's so much art out there to have. And you know, if one arts organization touches one person, it's worth it that another arts organization couldn't. However, what I'm hoping this conversation does is bring together all those organizations into a collective voice so that our identity is shaped as a city and not as its individual arts organizations, but its engagement in the arts as a whole. And yeah, as far as funding goes, what do we do to make that all work? You don't want the smaller voice to be shut out of the conversation ever, because sometimes that little pea under the 14 mattresses really makes a huge difference. So, you know, I hope, you know, the goal when we leave this evening of talk is that we have an understanding of the collective power of our arts community, that we might have helped to define a unity of our arts ambitions. That maybe our community knows better how to, you know, I want to say this way, the Arts Council of Indianapolis has really wants to support this. They want to be able to give people information on how you can support your arts organization. And it was no mistake to set it in December so that hopefully our, you know, the people that hear us can say, I believe in the arts. I'm going to go give my extra $100 or $50 or 5 cents, you know, to my favorite arts organization, not one arts organization, but any arts organization. To me, that's what it's about. Yes, you have to, you know, when you have a garden, you can't let everything grow wildly. I understand that. But good fertilizer goes a long way.
Sharon Gamble with U of I professor and music department chair Kathleen Hacker. Why Arts, Why Indy? Exploring the Future of Creative Culture in Indianapolis takes place at 7:30 on Monday evening, December 10th in the DeHaan Center at the University of Indianapolis. The discussion will be guided by questions submitted in advance by the public through the Facebook page at UIndyArts, again, Facebook at UIndyArts, or on Twitter at hashtag WhyArtsWhyIndy, and those are the words W-H-Y, WhyArtsWhyIndy, or you can also email to arts@uindy.edu, again, arts@uindy.edu.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. It's December, which means it's time for some nutcrackers. Butler Ballet just performed theirs. The Indiana Ballet Conservatory shows for next weekend are sold out. The Gregory Hancock Dance Theater performs their unique take on it this weekend at the Pike Performing Arts Center. And, last but not least, the Indianapolis School of Ballet wraps up the season with their Nutcracker from December 21st through the 23rd at the Scottish Rite Cathedral. Travis DiNicola spoke with the Indianapolis School of Ballet's artistic director, Victoria Liris, as well as their new director of communications and development, Betsy Busald, and 12-year-old dancer Liris Bonham about their production.
And here we are, another holiday season, another Nutcracker. You guys always do it so well. I'm really looking forward to talking with Liris, who is dancing the role of Clara. But before we get into that, Vicki, just give me a little bit of background on this school ballet, what you do, who you are, all those sorts of things.
Yes, thank you. I am the founding artistic director of the Indianapolis School of Ballet. The school opened its doors August of 2006, and we are thrilled to be producing this year our sixth annual production of The Nutcracker.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's great.
And the school has grown by leaps and bounds, where the enrollment now is about 225 dancers of wonderful ages from 4 through adult. And we have classes ongoing through the year for 32 weeks. And then we have a 6-week summer intensive.
You guys also have beautiful, beautiful dance studios located right downtown. Tell me briefly about those.
Yes. We have huge, three very large studios, state-of-the-art studios with sound equipment and pianos facing the state capitol. And wonderful daylight just coming in. It's been such a joy for me.
Was it down on Capitol and Michigan?
Capitol and Michigan, 502 North Capitol Avenue. And it's been a joy just to see how the city has flourished in the past 7 years that I've been at this location.
Well, and it's been very enjoyable for me to get to know your company as well and the productions that you do. And also, I mean, really just the great work that you do with kids. As you mentioned, I mean, just so many kids, boys and girls, that are taking your classes and participating in productions. Now, I know with Nutcracker, you have about 80 or so of those dancers?
Yes, we have 85 dancers working in this production, including adults from Riolo dance, which
they do the ballroom dancing.
Yes, the owner Marie Riolo established her business about 6 years ago, so she is Frau Stahlbaum, and it's her party we go to.
Oh, that's very nice.
And so we have quite a few adults from Riolo. Then we have some of my adult students who participate as Mouse Queen and also as Mother Ginger. We have our wonderful Ben Hall, who's coming back to do Mother Ginger again.
And I also saw that Chris Linger's coming back, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, Chris Linger.
Well, he's one of my favorite dancers. Yes. He's amazing.
What a powerhouse.
Yeah, he really is.
We have three dancers from Indiana University, the wonderful ballet department there, and two of them are my students from ISB, Chris Linger and Michelle Meltzer, and Gregory Tyndall. And actually, they're still my students because I am now adjunct faculty at Indiana University.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that. Congratulations.
Every Wednesday I teach there, so it's wonderful. And then also another one of our ISB graduates, Betsy Boxberger, who's a senior at Duke. She's coming back to dance also, to alternate with Michelle Meltzer at the roles of Sugar Plum and Snow Queen.
Nice. And then you also have Paul Vitale, who's coming back. He's been a great regular guest artist for you.
Always. He's as much of part of ISB as anybody, and certainly you know him so well from Coppelia and all these years of Drosselmeyer. The role was really created on him in 2007 for our first production, so Paul certainly comes back every year. And what's really exciting about this year is that I'm so proud of this particular time that we're putting on our party scene. Every year I have to select a group of dancers, young dancers, to play the party boys and the party girls. And usually the girls have played the party boy roles. We have all boys. We have 10 boys
great.
In the school right now. So,
you've had a little bit higher enrollment then for boys as students.
The boys' enrollment has been fabulous.
It's really great to hear.
Fabulous.
I mean, do you see, I mean, things like, you know, Billy Elliot helping that? I mean,
absolutely.
Do boys come in and say, oh, I saw
everything.
Billy Elliot.
What,
yeah.
Yeah, everything helps. Mm-hmm. Everything helps. And you know, as beautiful as the ballet is for the girls, and every little girl wants to be a ballerina. And certainly my mentor, George Balanchine, used to say, ballet is woman. We are nothing without our male counterpart. They're the ones who are supporting us,
That's
literally,
right.
You know, so.
Can't forget the guys. Well, let me ask you, Lyris. Lyris Bonham, you have been dancing with Indianapolis School of Ballet now for how many years? How many years have you been taking classes there?
Oh, how many years? Think about maybe 4 or more than, I don't know.
Yeah, so that's a good chunk. I mean, you're 12 years old, so good 30 of your life there. You've been dancing, which is awesome. And you mainly take ballet classes, is that right? Or do you take other classes too?
I take tap on Wednesdays, but that's it.
Okay, and then so last year you were in Nutcracker, right?
Yes.
And you were Clara then as well?
Yes.
So you get to return to the role.
Yeah.
So what is it that you like dancing about, like about Clara to dance?
I just love the character overall and what she, how she acts through all of the dance. I just love her.
So was there anything for you last year when you got to dance Clara for the first time that you thought, oh, I hope I get to do it again because I do something different this time or do it better? Or have you thought about that this year, how it might be different from last year?
Yeah, I Paula Chanel's. I really wanted to do better and different. I love Paula Chanel dance when I do it with them. So,
and tell us for our listeners who aren't familiar with that what that means.
Well, I heard that they're like clowns or and they're all dancing. They have Mother Ginger with them.
Mother Ginger is a great role.
Yeah. I love Mother Ginger.
Yeah, I remember last year when I saw the Indianapolis School of Ballet perform Nutcracker, Mother Ginger kind of ran away with it for a while. I mean, it's such a beautiful costume, Vicki, and such a big part of the production.
We introduced Mother Ginger last year. We have built on this production from year to year, and if you recall, the first year we had the whole concept was to make this production belong to the city of Indianapolis, and our party scene is based on the Morris Butler House. So that was the first drop that we had made by
it's a David beautiful Higgins. Beautiful backdrop,
gorgeous, of the Victorian parlor from the Morris Butler House. And then the second year we added the snow backdrop. The third year we added the facade of the Morris Butler House on Park Street, and the fourth year I've lost track of years. The fourth year, we added the Land of the Sweets, the Act 2 backdrop. And then last year, the big addition was Mother Ginger. And actually, Mother Ginger has had a little bit of a makeover this year. So she is even a little bit, even more elaborate and flamboyant.
She was
last year
huge and elaborate and flamboyant last year. So I can't wait to see what you guys do with her this year. So Lyris, I mean, you know, coming to this role of Clara after another year of dancing and practicing and getting better every day, you feel pretty confident about dancing the role this year?
Mostly. Yeah.
What's the most challenging part of it for you?
Just remembering all the things. I don't have a very good memory, so.
Lots of practice helps with
that. She has a very good memory. It's a pretty big role. It's a demanding role for a little girl. And what's important is to make it believable.
Mm-hmm.
So the acting is a major factor of this role, that you genuinely become that character. I never danced Clara as a little girl, and I've said this to my students so many times, because all little girls want to dance the role of Clara. I get letters from my students all the time, can I please be Clara? And I never danced Clara. I was always one of the party children, the Paula Chanels. And then at the old age of 19, mm-hmm. I was dancing with Pennsylvania Ballet. I danced Clara.
Oh.
I was so thrilled. So I have vivid memories, mm-hmm. not only of dancing Clara as a young adult, but even more vivid, my dancing all the other roles in Nutcracker.
Sure.
With New York City Ballet at that time. I was a student at School of American Ballet, so all my childhood experiences were that with New York City Ballet, dancing under the very careful eye of George Balanchine mm-hmm. and the proscenium wings. And for me, my best memories, really, of my career, are many of them are from my childhood. So I know for Lyris, this is something special, and I know with Lyris, aside from the challenges of the technical and artistic aspect of the ballet, Lyris has juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. So for her, this has been a phenomenal milestone in her young life.
Well, Lyris, congratulations on that as well. I mean, to achieve so much so young. Is ballet a big part of your life, Lyris? I mean,
yes.
Is it? Yeah. Is it kind of favorite thing to do when you're not in school? And
yeah.
Yeah. Do you take classes during the summer as well, I'm guessing?
Yeah, I do.
Something that you think you might want to pursue in the future, or too soon to say?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Probably something to do with it, but
yeah. Yeah. Any? Have you thought about other roles you'd really like to dance? And now that you've got Clara under your belt,
all of them.
Well, good. It's good to be ambitious, Betsy Basald. Let me turn it to you just a bit. And congratulations on your new role as director of marketing and development for Indianapolis School Ballet. Is that close to the correct title?
Yes, that's the correct title. Thank
Excellent.
You.
Yeah. Well, welcome aboard, and tell us about how we can go see Nutcracker, and because number of performances. And what I love about your production of Nutcracker is that even if you don't have kids who are in it, because you bring in all these great guest artists and because of the staging stuff, it's something that anyone would love to go see. And
that's right.
I think that's a really
important thing. It's a really family-friendly show, and we have great show times for anyone to attend. We open Friday night on December 21st at 7:30, and then the following day we offer our first matinee Saturday at 2 o'clock, followed by an evening show at 7:30, and then we close out the weekend with our final show on Sunday, December 23rd at 3 o'clock. And tickets can be purchased through our website, which is www.indieballet.org. And the ticket office is also open if you call 317-955-7525 Monday through Friday from 9 to 4, basically, or 4 mm-hmm. to 8 at night. And we have a varied range of prices as well. So it's an affordable show as well as family friendly.
And all the performances are at the Scottish Rite Cathedral.
That's right. We're very fortunate to have a great partnership with them and to perform in that historic building. And it's really gorgeous theater
if you haven't been before. Beautiful, beautiful stage. I mean, it's such a great place to see ballet performed. I mean, the area where the audience sits is as much of a part of it as the stage is. I mean, you're very fortunate to have that as a home for your performances.
We are indeed.
Yeah, great. Hey, give me a quick update on what is happening after the holidays. Once you complete your run of Nutcrackers, what's up for next year, next spring?
May 17th and 19th for A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh, great.
And it's funny how I was thinking of what you said about feeling so much part of the performance when you're mm-hmm. sitting in the audience. Well, there's a surprise in Midsummer Night's Dream that the audience is kind of even more involved.
Oh, great.
Travis DiNicola with the Indianapolis School of Ballet's Victoria Lyris and Betsy Busald and dancer Lyris Bonham. Their production of The Nutcracker takes place at the Scottish Rite Cathedral from December 21st through the 23rd. For more information, visit indieballet.org, indieballet.org, or call 955-7525, again, 955-7525.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
It seems like time is really short this time of year, and so is our calendar. So let's jump right in.
To that calendar we call.
What do we do? Right? What do you have?
Well, you know what? I've actually got one more nutcracker.
What?
Yes, it's true. There's one other nutcracker, and this is Ballet Theatre of Carmel, Performer's Edge, and they're presenting their 2012 Holiday of Dance and Nutcracker Suite, which includes an original ballet, The Celestial Celebration, and it's taking place on Sunday, December 16th at 7 p.m. at the Westfield High School Auditorium, and they also have an extended version of the Nutcracker Suite with the addition of the famous battle scene. So yet there's even more nutcrackers to see.
That's fantastic. You're all cracked up, though. The Indianapolis Men's Chorus is doing something a little different this year for their holiday concerts. The concert is called Christmas in London, and it features music in the Anglican tradition and baritone Charles Stanton and organist Simon Thomas Jacobs, as well as many more wonderful performers. The performances take place on Friday, December 14th and Saturday, December 15th at 7:30 at St. Paul's Episcopal Cathedral. Great place to have Anglican tradition music. You can find out more at indiechoruses.org.
Hey, everyone's favorite electric violinist jazz musician, Kathy Morris, is having her holiday party, and it's taking place at the Athenaeum coming up on Monday and Tuesday nights, December 10th and the 11th, both nights at 7 p.m. It's a fundraiser for Gleaners Food Bank, the Noble Centers, the Julian Center, and the Humane Society, and it is a who's who of jazz musicians in town, along with Kathy Morris, Steve Dokken, Gary Walters, Everett Green, Tony Medeiros, Daryl Spurlock, Becky Archibald, Laura Glover, Greg Bacon, the list goes, Linda
Gracious.
Burris, it goes on and on and on. Who knows who's going to show up? Both nights, again, 7 p.m., Athenaeum Theater, a Kathy Morris holiday party for a great cause, and there'll be lots of great music.
Well, we have a lot of music on today's calendar. This Sunday, there's a performance of distinguished professor of IU, Menachem Pressler's 89th birthday, and it's 8 o'clock on Sunday the 16th in our hall, and it includes music by Schubert and many, many more composers, of course. So you can check that out in Bloomington this weekend.
Hey, things do not end at the Fringe in the winter. No, not at all. In fact, they got lots of events going on, including Jabberwocky, which is their partnership and collaboration with Storytelling Arts of Indiana, and it is free, and it is coming up on Tuesday the 11th at the Indie Fringe Basile Theater, where they have finished construction on their alley, which is pretty cool. But anyways, this Tuesday night at 5:30, they are going to be talking about Season for Giving, and so lots of different people are going to be talking about why they volunteer and how they volunteer and sharing their stories about volunteering for Big Brothers and the Museum of Art and Indie Reads and Riley Hospital, and it should be a lot of fun, and if you want to share your story, you can too. Again, Tuesday the 11th, 5:30 at the Indie Fringe Building.
Fantastic. And by the way, don't go to Bloomington this weekend for the Menachem Pressler concert.
I misspoke.
That's next weekend.
Next weekend.
So if you're looking at your calendar saying, Sharon, less coffee, you're right. Hey, however, this coming week, 12-12-12, a very auspicious day, you have two choices. One is to be at the Arts Garden for a very exciting announcement about the future of arts funding.
Mm-hmm.
Very groovy. Travis and I know the secret, but we won't tell you. You need to go there. Or maybe you can do both on 12-12-12 at the Jazz Kitchen at 6 p.m. The Holiday Jazz Showcase, a fundraiser for the Indianapolis Jazz Foundation, is coming up with more performers than you could possibly list, including some of the people you just talked about at that other fabulous event.
And I know Bill Langton's going to be playing at that one, and Oliver Nelson Jr.
Sophie
That's going to be a great
lots
one.
And lots of great performers at the Jazz Kitchen, 12-12-12, 6 p.m.
Lots of great jazz holiday music coming
up.
Hey, if you're listening to us on Thursday, then start planning right now for Friday night, First Friday. Lots of great art exhibits going on. Of course, Primary Gallery down at the Murphy Arts Center is having their toys exhibit, the annual toys, as well as Tiny at Gallery 924,
right.
And then Metamorphosis over at Wuglaku Studio. It's Eye Photography by Sarah McCracken. So lots of great art. And of course, Harrison Center.
And don't forget Indie Artist Colony, which is doing an
of
the world show in advance of the Mayan calendar, having all the planets align and the world coming to an end on 12-21-12. So
see the art now before the world comes to an
end.
There we go. We'll be back next week with a calendar we call.
What do we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Where's the best seat in the house at an ISO concert? Dress circle, middle of the main floor? How about behind the kettle drums? For more than a quarter of a century, Tom Akins had what he believes is the very best view of the music making. And he's written about his era with the orchestra in a new memoir called Behind the Copper Fence, A Lifetime on Timpani. Sharon Gamble invited him to begin by reading a passage about his first Carnegie Hall concert.
Carnegie Hall, 1965. I felt the presence of the ghosts. I knew they were there, watching, listening, ready in an instant to criticize any small error, reticent to grant approval. I couldn't see them, of course, but I knew their names. Freese, Schwarr, Zulk, Metzinger, White. All had excelled where I now dared to enter, the stage of Carnegie Hall, sacred territory indeed. They had passed the mantle carefully to their successors, Hinger, Firth, Goodman, Leonard, Begun, Kraft, Beck, Rabiot, all of whom who had been more than equal to the task. Now it was my turn. I thought of Cloyd Duff, who had preceded me in Indianapolis by some 25 years and went on to the Cleveland Orchestra to become one of the timpani greats. What role did his first Carnegie concert play in that path? What would it play in mine? Carnegie Hall was about to become the alpha in my career with a major symphony. Little did I know that 26 years later, it would also become the Omega.
So, there were a couple of false starts on other instruments before the timpani grabbed hold of you.
Well, I have my mother to thank for that.
May she rest in peace. She indeed. Meant well.
And a fine woman she was, believe me. But she thought her son perhaps ought to play the trumpet or the clarinet or anything other than a drum, because she visualized a 40-foot bass drum sitting in her living room. And that was not quite the concept of music that she had in mind. So she begged me to go try the others. And fortunately for myself and the rest of the musical world, I was an abject failure on both the trumpet and the clarinet. I actually got some sound out of the trumpet. The clarinet and I have never had what we might call a positive relationship.
Although you have friends who are clarinetists.
Yes,
we should
probably clarify that.
And trumpeters, certainly. There are a lot of musicians who play more than one instrument, but if they play more than one instrument, they tend to either have good embouchure or good hands. They tend not to have both, right?
That's true, but when you think about percussion, I think some of the things that people don't know about percussion is that the course of study is all-inclusive throughout the entire family up to a point. It's very similar to the medical profession. Someone who studies percussion is required to learn to play to a certain level of proficiency the entire family of instruments. Now, this includes things like the drums, snare drum, bass drum, cymbals, small instruments like that. It includes the mallet keyboard family of xylophone and marimba and vibes and all that. It includes timpani, the pitched drums, as it were, and it includes sometimes the drum set or other elements of percussion. And of course, percussion is a family that is always welcoming additions to the family as people's creative brain begins to think
Gold
of what else you can hit.
Fish bowls, et cetera.
If it's out there and you can hit it, hey, come on in. We're having fun.
For someone who's not had the advantage of sitting on the old stage terrace seats and watching a timpanist or maybe has never studied, how do you change the pitch of the timpani?
The whole idea is that the head that is stretched across the timpani bowl usually made of copper, the tension that is applied to that stretched head across the bowl is regulated by a mechanical system somehow or another. There are different mechanical systems, but to shorten the explanation, somehow that mechanical system is changed by the player in order to alter the tension. And if you stretch the head tighter, the pitch will go up. If you relax the tension, the pitch will go back down. It's like plunking on a rubber band between thumb and forefinger, and stretching it and changing the tension of that. The same is true, by the way, of violin strings and a few other elements in music like that. The tighter you stretch something, the higher the pitch goes. So the timpanist is required to play in tune to a specific pitch, which sets them apart from other drums in the musical fabric. And the mechanism, there are several, as I said, for being able to make that change, but that's what's going on. So when a timpanist leans over and gets very close to the drum head in mid-concert, contrary to popular joke, he's really not trying to smell the drum head or anything of the sort. He's really listening quite carefully and very quietly to the pitch that he has, because he needs to make certain that that pitch is the required pitch as directed by the composer.
And how changeable is that? I mean, you're the king of jokes, some of which find their way into this lovely memoir. But, you know, there's the old joke about the harpist spending half the time tuning and the other half of the time retuning.
You make an interesting point, because harp and timpani have something in similarity, and that is that what you see is only half the story. There's an awful lot of activity in both the harp and the timpani that's going on with the feet. So there's action down below. There's pedal movement, and most of the timpani tuning mechanisms are pedal operated. Therefore, these pitch changes are really being done with your feet. And, you know, it's all grandiose to be in the spotlight with all these fancy movements of sticks flying through the air and great curlicues being done and all that kind of stuff. And the harpist is, you know, going up and down the string row with all these great hand movements. But what's really, you know, the truth of the matter is, if you win and lose with what you're doing with your feet, not with what you're doing with your hands alone.
So there's coordination that most people don't see.
It is. Sometimes there's a phrase in percussion called four-way coordination, which means two hands and two feet doing four separate things. And that's not uncommon, particularly in timpani and particularly also in drum set.
You have a great way of describing in this book the role of the timpanist as the conductor from the rear of the orchestra. Can you say more about that?
That was a phrase that was taught to me by my first major timpani teacher, Fred Begun, who was the timpanist for 48 years with the National Symphony Orchestra in Washington, D.C. And he regarded himself that way, and he had a very good idea of transferring that belief to his students. The whole idea of timpani is one of providing a great deal of anchor to, shall we say, the back of the band, which then permeates the entire orchestra as it moves forward. Of course, you're solid rhythmically. Of course, you're playing the exact notes exactly at the same time that the composer dictates it to be, and you are an integral part of the ensemble. But you also are centering the pitch for certain fundamental tones in the scale that the composer has written for the entire orchestra at that point. You are shading by virtue of dynamic contrast, either projecting in certain solo moments or supporting both brass and other orchestral families at that point. So there's an awful lot that goes on at the timpani position that, in effect, helps the interpretation that is being dictated first from the podium up front. So it's a supportive role, but it is it's definitely a compatriot role.
It's not unlike what the bass players, the string bass players, are doing.
I think that's true, except we have the ability to not only, by virtue of simple percussive effects, we can project more. And in that regard, that sets us a little bit apart from the bass players. But my third major teacher, Dan Hinger, who was the timpanist first with the Philadelphia Orchestra for a long time, and then he moved to the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra for the latter years of his career, his whole concept of sound was that of being an extension of the bass section. He was all about quality sound, good pitch, centered fundamental, all of these things that made for a very, very musical expression of timpani playing, as opposed to just a percussive expression of timpani playing.
You had the chance to work with some amazing teachers and be part of some technical innovations on not just the timpani, but in particular the timpani. But I want you to tell a little bit about the journey of getting the Kraft Concerto birthed. You were sort of the midwife.
I think midwife might be a good, I hadn't thought of that term, but that's not bad. Bill Kraft and I met each other in 1968 I had, of course, heard of him before then. We spent some wonderful time together when the ISO was on tour out in California, and we got to know each other a little bit better. He then came to Terre Haute as the featured composer, the guest star, as it were, for one of the contemporary music festivals in which the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra used to participate. That festival, by the way, is still going on the campus of Indiana State University. We became closer friends then, and of course this whole thing was sparked by the fact that my first major teacher, Fred Begun, had done the premiere of the Robert Parris Timpani Concerto in 1958 in Washington with the National Symphony. That was a great moment in timpani history, and I wanted one too, you know. Freddie had
you?
His concerto, I wanted mine.
Sure.
So one thing led to another. I was able to talk with Bill Kraft, and John Nelson and I were good friends as well as very good working colleagues together during his years as music director with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. And I'll shorten the story a little bit because the full story is in the book. And I had the opportunity to propose the idea to John Nelson that we have a timpani concerto, that it be premiered by the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra with him conducting, and that we take it as far as it would go. We would record it, we would make a television special out of it, we would do whatever we could do to put this thing on the map, and we needed to pick the right composer, of course, to do this. Well, he was amenable to the idea. We had a very fruitful discussion about it. We thought about two different composers, one being Bill Kraft, the other one being Michael Colgrass. Both came from the same background. They were percussionists first. They became composers. The composing took over their life. Their percussion playing sort of went by the wayside, so to speak, because they had no more time left in their life to play percussion. They were too busy composing and doing all the things that composers and musical figures do at that level.
But still, Bill Kraft had some resistance.
He did. Bill Kraft had spent his life playing timpani in the Los Angeles Philharmonic up to that point. He knew the instrument intimately well, which was exactly why I wanted to have him in the first position of offering the opportunity to him. And he said, much to my great surprise, I don't think that the timpani is expressive enough to be able to carry a full concerto. We can do lots of effects. There are certainly plenty of musical effects that we can do, but I don't know that we can write a bona fide, full, legitimate concerto for timpani that will make musical sense. Well, to say the least, I was taken aback by that. Here's the perfect guy to do the work, and he was a little reluctant to undertake the task. But he thought about it some more, and I will admit to applying a little bit of psychology as best I could. You know, Bill and I agreed that he would come to Indianapolis at some point, listen to me play extensively in my home studio, because what he wanted to do in every concerto that he wrote, never mind what the instrument was, he wanted to get to know the personality, the musical personality, and the techniques and the favorite tricks of the player who would do the premiere, so that the piece did reflect that person that was going to introduce it to the world. Bill came, we talked, we will move forward on the idea, and he finally agreed that he would indeed undertake the task, but he wasn't quite sure how it was going to work out. So in order to break up the writer's block composer variation that he had, I suggested to him that with all of these different effects and tricks that we were experimenting about and, you know, different devices, why didn't he think about them individually and perhaps write a theme and variations piece, which would sort of categorize the various effects, and it would begin to line them up. It would put them in blocks and, you know, he could sort them out and fix them as he wished.
And be less daunting than a traditional three-movement concerto.
Well, sometimes that's the way it works. And, of course, authors do the same thing. They write exercises. Artists do certain sample color things just to see how things are going to work together. And they organize all these exercises, if you will. Composers do very much the same thing. They'll write exercises, not intending to use them in a specific spot, and then at a later date begin to pull things from here and there, and suddenly there's a piece of music that's beginning to unfold.
Sometimes when a composer is working with a soloist, there are drafts that go back and forth, but that didn't happen in this case.
No, it did not. Bill did not show me a single thing until the whole thing was done. As a matter of fact, one of the things that he did for inspiration to, you know, it was okay for me to be suggesting theme and variations, but that really didn't play all that well with him, to tell you the truth. He was kind of amenable to the idea, but I think it was to keep me quiet. What did work for him was a trip to the McDowell Colony in New England. He had been there before. It's an artist colony established by the composer and pianist Edward McDowell. And it is a wonderful place of creativity. Artists, writers, musicians, various disciplines in the arts world have come there and found inspiration for whatever the magic potion is that happens there. It does seem to work. And in this case, it worked again because Bill spent a summer there. The summer of 1983, he spent a good chunk of time there. And lo and behold, it all came together.
And one morning you got a package?
I first got a phone call. I got a phone call, picked it up, said hello, and the phone almost jumped out of my hand. It was Bill. I got it. I didn't have to ask, oh, really? Who is this?
Yeah. Or what is it?
I kind of knew who was on the other end of the phone. He says, you're going to love it. It's great. I said, a theme and variations? He says, oh, no. No, it's a real concerto. It's just the way it's supposed to be. It's three movements and it works great and you're going to love it. And I said, okay, when do I see it? He said, when I'm finished. I said, you're not sending me samples in advance? No, you're going to get the whole thing. Well, I got the whole thing something like 5 months in advance of the premiere, which is wonderful because that isn't always the way things go. Sometimes premiering artists get their work in slices, and you get to put together this and that and then the other, and sometimes it comes in, you know, with the ink still wet. But in this case, Bill put the whole thing together. I had it 5 months in advance, and I was able to go to work on the whole piece. But then I had to do the conditioning part of it. Playing a concerto is different from playing daily in an orchestra, and I had to get into concerto shape.
Sharon Gamble with Tom Akins. His new memoir called Behind the Copper Fence, A Lifetime on Timpani, is full of backstage and onstage tales of music, mischief, the changing landscape of classical music in general, and the ISO in particular, and how to use Haydn string quartet mutes. Go to BehindTheCopperFence.com to learn more. Again, BehindTheCopperFence.com, where you can read sample chapters and purchase the book. It's also available at Indie Reads Books. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll take a look at a book on artist Franklin Booth.
I'll find out a bit more of the history of 50 years of lights on the circle for the holidays.
And I'll get a preview of Christ Church Cathedral's Messiah performance. Plus, we'll have that calendar of events we call
What do we do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.